Cyber 24 is presented by our friends at Valcom. Valcom is a Utah-based IT solutions and services provider with a drive for getting IT right. From ironclad security to computing and beyond, Valcom's 35-plus years of experience means they have the experience and the expertise to help your business from the desktop to the data center. Please check them out at VLCM.com. That's VLCM.com. Welcome to the Cyber 24 podcast, the weekly pod dedicated to helping business and governmental leaders better understand the often intimidating topic of cybersecurity so you can make better decisions for your organization. I'm Marty Carpenter of 24/9. I work in strategic communication, public affairs, government relations. And this week, we look at how tech is impacting the spy game, the spillover impacts on regular citizens from international cyber attacks, and yet another round of congressional rumblings on antitrust tech bills. Our guest expert, Dan Schuyler from NICE CX1. All right, welcome into another episode of Cyber 24. Dan, thanks so much for joining us. And Dan, before we get going on our three hot topics for this week, there was something I didn't get you a chance to make a point on last week when we were talking about why businesses are hesitant to contact the authorities when they're hit with ransomware or some other type of cybersecurity incident. So I wanted to give you that chance right off the top of the show today. Why do you think that businesses are hesitant to reach out to the authorities when they get hit?
Well, you, Marty, thanks for having me again. And you actually helped me answer this question. Marty, put yourself in the shoes. Well, you are a business person, but if your business got hit with ransomware, what's your number one priority?
Getting back to business. You want the interruption gone.
Exactly. Every minute that you can't function as a business is revenue that's lost. And you've got to imagine as a business owner that that puts you in a really precarious position. And the number one priority for you is restoring business operations. Clearly, contacting the authorities should be is something you should do. But for most business owners, when their business is shut down because of they've been hit with ransomware, their number one priority is restoring business operations. And they're not even thinking about, hey, should I call the FBI? Should I call the police? Yeah. And so I just wanted to bring that up because if you clearly that's your priority as a business person, I've got to do whatever I can to restore business operations. Now, I do want to add that contacting the authorities could actually be proactive in helping you restore those business operations for all the reasons we discussed. So it shouldn't be something that you should not do, but it's something that you should try to prioritize as best you can.
Yeah. To me, it goes back, Dan, to the point that we've made a number of times on various episodes of this podcast. And that is what you don't want to do is make these decisions for the first time when you get hit with ransomware, right? If you have a plan in place, an incident response plan, and you've worked through these questions, you've rehearsed what you're going to do so that you have that plan there that's, as we say, break glass, open binder, and you say, oh, we've been hit with ransomware, pull the book, here's what it says we're supposed to do. First thing we do is we start logging, we start logging what we're doing, and we figure out what the problem is. We reach out to the authorities, we reach out to our, you start walking through that process. We got to contact our legal counsel. We got to figure out investigatively what's going on. We got to reach out to the authorities. All these steps that are easy to forget at least one of them when you have the pressure on, you know, it's the same principle of why sports teams practice. They have a strategy and they practice that so that when they get in the games and the lights are bright and the pressure's on, they perform the way they want to when the emotions weren't high. And it's the same thing for a business, right? You got to plan all that out. And contacting the authority should be somewhere in your plan so that when something happens and all of a sudden everything's coming at you a million miles a minute, you have a plan that you can just go follow.
Yeah. An incident response plan is an inanimate object. It doesn't have a heartbeat, but it will be your best friend if you suffer a ransomware attack or a data breach. So absolutely, if you don't have an incident response plan, your priority should be to start developing one today. Absolutely. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. Yeah.
I think everyone is pretty much on board with the idea of have a plan before the emergency. It's just interesting that this is still not an emergency that most businesses or enough businesses really plan for and think through ahead of time, right? Like every building you go into, every public building has exits marked and has a fire escape. We've planned that out. We have fire drills every so often. So you have a briefing to know where you're supposed to go in case of an emergency. There's signs in every elevator. Don't take the elevator if there's a fire. Go down the stairs. We plan all those things out. And so it's really interesting that some businesses don't sort of have a plan, even a fundamental plan of what they're going to do should something pop up, so that they can, back to your point, get back to business operations as quickly as possible. Because as you know, in business, time is money. And so you don't want to be down for any minute or any second longer than you need to be.
Yeah. And just as critical as having a plan is testing the plan. The plan will do you no good if you're not testing it and refining it on at least an annual basis.
Yeah, absolutely true. Okay, Dan, I appreciate it. Let's jump into our first topic for the day. Dan, do you like spy movies? You're a James Bond guy, any kind of espionage type of film fan?
Yeah, they're in the top of my genres of movies that I like. Yes.
Yeah, I love that show that was on FX a couple of years back, The Americans, that was about Russian spies who were living in the United States as regular old Americans, but carrying out operations for the Soviet Union. So yes. Interesting. And that leads us to our first topic today: tech causing challenges for American spies. This, according to the Wall Street Journal, artificial intelligence is making it easier and faster for foreign adversaries to sort through data and identify spies. While advanced technologies will help U.S. authorities gather intelligence, the same technologies will likely give authoritarian societies like China and Russia an advantage because they can exert greater control over them. All right, Dan, if tech and AI are making espionage more difficult for the U.S. and you know, more difficult for really any country because the other guys have good tech as well, doesn't that just make the advantage go to the most innovative country and everyone's trying to stay ahead of the curve?
Yes, and you've probably heard it said a couple times in the recent James Bond movies, is that the James Bond type of spies are, for lack of a better word, dinosaurs, if you will. We're not sending, you know, guys in DB5s and with cool little gadgets into countries to perform spy operations. It has become a cyber game now, and it really is spy versus spy. Which spy, if you will, which country has the best technology, not only to, you know, facilitate the operations that they've gone into that country to facilitate, but also to keep from being detected as well. And you know, it's a spy versus spy game. Whoever has the best technology at the time usually comes out ahead. But to answer your question, yes, countries like China and Russia that have greater autonomy with what they can do with regards to privacy in their countries certainly have the upper hand or upper leg, if you will, with regards to what they can do with regards to spying on people in general, including spies from other countries.
Yeah. I think it's really fascinating, this idea that essentially, you think of these spy movies, and that's, you know, essentially what we understand as citizens of what spying is, but they sort of find ways to blend in, find ways to fade into the pattern, right? So the pattern can't be picked out, so they don't stand out. And essentially what this is saying to me is you can't hide from a computer that can run billions of lines of code in a second, right? Like, it will find the pattern. And the more we have surveillance cameras and devices being tracked and, you know, people moving from one point to the next where we can actually see their progress and things and track them a number of different ways, even if you're trying to be somewhat off the grid, it's really difficult even for a trained spy in this case to evade what the artificial intelligence can pick up in a pattern.
Yeah, absolutely. And the countries you mentioned have, you know, a wide array of CCTV across the country and facial recognition, more so than we do in the U.S. And clearly, to your point, that's an advantage, especially when you've got all this data and you can run, you know, AI against this data to determine who is a legitimate person and who is potentially a spy. So I agree completely.
Yeah. A couple of recent examples Show us how technology can expose spies. Again, according to the Wall Street Journal, a suspected U.S. intelligence officer held a supposedly clandestine meeting with Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, in 2017, days before Kim Jong-nam was assassinated. That meeting was actually captured on a hotel's security camera. I think a lot of people in our audience have probably seen this. It's black and white. It's a little bit grainy, but I think they meet at a bar and in a casino or in a hotel of some kind. And it's caught on security camera, and eventually they could sort of unwind and see what happened. Not that they could prevent what happened, but that they could go back and pick that apart. And then in December, an investigative website called Bellingcat named and published photographs of three Russian intelligence officers who it said showed and shadowed and attempted to kill Russian opposition politicians. Bellingcat used phone and travel data to track the intelligence operatives. So really interesting to see, you know, if you pop up somewhere on this and the computers can help sort of figure out, this is where you were at one point in time, and then go unravel it and figure out, you know, maybe how to catch up to you or how to anticipate your next move. Certainly poses some new concerns for all countries that are trying to figure out what their friends and foes are up to at all times, as they trust but verify, right?
Well, especially if you're a country that has access to all that footage and all that data.
That's right. Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, let's move on. Topic number two, civilians in Iran and Israel get caught up in the cyber war. And is this going to happen eventually everywhere in the world? This, again, according to the Wall Street Journal, Israel and Iran have engaged in a covert cyber war that has widened to include civilian targets on a large scale. They say two U.S. defense officials, spoke on the condition of anonymity and said that a recent cyber attack on Iran's nationwide fuel distribution system to Israel was under attack. That attack paralyzed 4,300 gas stations, took 12 days to have service fully restored. And just a couple of days later, there were cyber attacks against major medical facilities and popular LGBTQ dating site that's based in Israel, which officials have attributed to Iran. These attacks are thought to be the first to do widespread harm to many civilians. We've talked about this in the past, Dan. You know, hackers taking on critical infrastructure, dams, food supply. We ran into a little bit of that with the meat processing company that was attacked earlier in the year. I don't like the trend of seeing this sort of creeping toward regular people.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I would add that the U.S. power grid is very vulnerable. There's a great TED Talk about we don't heed the warnings. We don't heed the warning signs until we've actually suffered a catastrophe. And the warning signs are there. Our infrastructure, especially the power grid, is very vulnerable. And Congress knows this. They have been advised repeatedly about the vulnerabilities, but we have not taken proactive steps to address those. And, you know, if you bring this back home, a power failure across any swath of the U.S. would be pretty devastating, and the long-term ramifications would be pretty severe as well. And so we're going to see more of these cyber attacks. I'm just very nervous that we may see a cyber attack against, you know, more power companies, more privately owned companies in the U.S. That could have long-lasting and significant ramifications within the U.S. itself. And we will continue to see, you know, countries like Israel and Iran continue to wage cyber warfare against each other.
Mm-hmm. Not to follow down a rabbit hole, but what you're saying about the power grid is really interesting. What's the solution on that? Is it each individual local power company or regional power company that just has to have better cybersecurity protections? Is it, I mean, when you say the grid, to me, that means everyone interlocked is somehow vulnerable because there's a weak link somewhere. So is it something that like individual companies need to take seriously, that collectively they need to, that nationally we need to, or, you know, all of the above.
Clearly, it needs to be a nationally driven objective, if you will. And when I say they're interconnected, Each grid has some of its own autonomy, but there are parts of the grid that each grid that rely on power or information from the other grids. And so if we had an area of the country that suffered a cyber attack and took down that area's power, it could have cascading effects across the country. Clearly, it would demonstrate to the attackers, you know, we were successful. Let's continue our attack and let's try to take down the other power grids across the country. But it's going to be a collaborative effort. State, local, and private organizations need to come together and take this seriously. They've talked about funding a project to start overhauling our power grid with regards to cyber defenses, but we really haven't seen a lot of progress with respect to that. And every day that we delay is one day closer to a cyber attack that could potentially take down the entire grid.
Yeah, scary stuff. U.S. authorities have warned of Iranian attempts to hack into computer networks of American critical infrastructure, including hospitals, that according to the New York Times. All right.
Well, the question is, you say to somebody, you know, I'm here to protect your systems from a cyber attack. And their initial response is, well, we've never been hacked. Well, you don't know that you've never been hacked. You could be hacked right now and not know it. That's what makes a good hacker good, is they are in your system and you don't know that they're in your system or they've been in your system.
Yeah. Do you have to prove that they've never been there or that they're not there, or do you just assume that they're not? It's sort of a dangerous game to play for sure.
Exactly. I would like to add that Congress recently passed the infrastructure bill, which does provide significant funding for the power grid, for improving cybersecurity and the infrastructure of the power grid. However, I don't think throwing money at a problem necessarily fixes the problem. There has to be some organized project or initiative around that money to truly develop a strategy for improving the power grid. I'm glad to see that there's funding there. I'm sure it will have a positive impact. But considering the vulnerability of our power grid, again, it needs to be a collaborative effort. Those funds need to be used to develop a strategy to improve our power grid.
With the increasing number of employees working remotely everywhere around the world, businesses are now looking at supporting a mostly, if not fully, remote workforce. But just because security at the office is no longer a high priority, that doesn't mean that remote security should be overlooked or be difficult to manage. To enable remote work security at your business, Valcom recommends WatchGuard Automation Core. WatchGuard's automation security platform speeds up processes, kills threats, and empowers IT teams to do more with less. With WatchGuard, you can apply zero trust principles across networks and applications and help remote employees enable secure Wi-Fi networks. To learn more about remote work security, visit vlcmtech.com/watchguard. That's vlcmtech.com/watchguard. Using Microsoft 365 for your business productivity tools certainly has many advantages. Easy, user-friendly accessibility from anywhere at any time, simplified email access, and reduced costs of business operations and management. However, the migration and use of Microsoft 365 isn't without security risks. Barracuda Essentials provides the industry's most comprehensive security and data protection solution for Microsoft 365. With Barracuda, you can stop spam, viruses, prevent data loss, and turn employees into a line of defense against phishing attacks. For peace of mind, learn more about Barracuda Essentials for Microsoft 365 at vlcmtech.com. That's vlcmtech.com. All right, let's move on to topic number three. Bipartisan momentum grows in the Senate for antitrust tech bills. This is, maybe to the point just before the breakdown that we're not taking the threat to the power grid and other infrastructure seriously enough. Now let's talk about Congress trying to react and put some antitrust measures in as you know, a lot of tech gets really consolidated in just a handful of companies. And as that's the way the world works more and more often, that's making more and more politicians and people and special interest groups more nervous about that fact. So again, from the Wall Street Journal, lawmakers in both parties are endorsing bills that would introduce legal constraints on search engines, e-marketplaces, app stores, and other online platforms. An earlier push in the House for antitrust legislation and the House Judiciary Committee passed far-reaching bills back in June. And now 12 senators on the other side of Congress are backing the proposed American Innovation and Choice Online Act, which would treat large marketplaces like Amazon or Google search engine like a dominant railroad operator that is central to commerce. The growing momentum for antitrust legislation targeting tech giants comes as lawmakers push for greater privacy protections for children and others. All right, Dan, we've talked about possible legislation before. I always have my doubts because by the time Congress can sort of wrap its head around putting measures in place for security, the bad guys have worked around it. This is a different thing because this is saying, hey, this is how we're going to treat these things that are becoming incredibly fundamental to American commerce. Do you think we'll see any action from Congress, or is this sort of another false start? Do you think eventually they take on the big tech companies like they, you know, like the U.S. did with Ma Bell, and kind of break the company up or put some strict guidelines in place for them?
You know, that's a good question, Marty. I'm not going to mention names, but there's a huge social media giant out there that has survived a tsunami of privacy and data breach issues, and yet they are still in business and doing quite well. I think this, you know, this goes back to, we've talked about this before in the past, the problem with social media and the addiction that people have to social media with regards to, you know, being anti-competitive or antitrust. Clearly, the consolidation of these companies is a concern as it gets harder for them to control these companies, and it gets harder for other companies to compete when you're going up against these, you know, mega giants. So I'm hopeful that we'll see something from a legislative perspective. I wish, you know, I always say, you know, I wish we didn't have to get Congress involved. I wish these companies would take it upon themselves to address these issues instead of being legislative to do so, because the legislation is always imperfect. Very rarely benefits the consumer. I've always been an advocate of let's resolve these issues outside the legislative process. But clearly from, you know, past experience, we're not seeing that happening. And so we're likely to see legislation. When that's going to happen is anybody's guess. Clearly there's other issues that our Congress is dealing with right now, but it's likely that we will see something. I just don't know. I would have thought we would have seen something already, but it's anybody's guess when we'll see something from Congress regarding privacy and antitrust regulations against these tech giants.
I read just this morning or yesterday that Utah Senator Mike Lee, in a hearing with officials from Instagram, so from Meta, Facebook, Instagram, all, you know, tomato, tomato, all one big company, you know, talking about sort of the impact that Instagram has on young people from a mental health perspective and so on. And I thought it was interesting because Senator Lee told the representative from Instagram, you know, whether you like it or not, you are the new tobacco and you have an impact on public health, which I think is different as an attack than antitrust, right? Like you're getting so big that you're becoming too large a portion of the economy and you get into that too big to fail that we all remember from not too many years ago, 2008, and you know, with the banks and such. And you know, like I said, I made an even more dated reference with Ma Bell. There are people listening who've never had a landline probably, but you know, you can just see that there are some larger fundamental concerns, whether it's public health, mental health, just, you know, how big these handful of companies are getting. And you know, I'm sure that this won't catch them by surprise, that they're all trying to maneuver and position themselves so that they don't end up with an outcome forced upon them that they don't want. And that's both a lobbying legislative approach to make sure that, you know, politicians and elected officials understand your position and see things the way you see it as a company, and, you know, trying to show the public that you care about these things. This is where I think Apple's been really brilliant, because they've made their positioning on even just selling hardware and using their software based around privacy, right? I think they're very ahead of the wave where people are starting to say, maybe it's not to a tipping point, maybe it's not critical mass yet, but I think there more and more people are saying, maybe I don't need to rush to put everything in my life out on the internet and give away all this data. Now I am concerned about where my data is, but to some extent, you just have to do that to navigate the world. And I look at things, Dan, like, you know, even the general approach to this in Europe. And I was just in Europe a couple of weeks ago, and every time you got on a website, it essentially said, "Hey, we've got to let you know that we're going to track you, or, you know, so you can go away." But it's not really an option, because you still have to use most websites. And, you know, you have to interact with these companies to kind of function. So just the fact that someone tells you, "Hey, we're going to take your data," and we've all been there. We've all gone through a wave of websites where it pops up and says, "Hey, you know, do you accept cookies or not?" and what's your choice, right? Like that didn't actually stop a problem. It just was one more annoying thing for me, for you as the consumer, to have to click and say, "Yes, let's move on with this." But that doesn't mean you actually wanted them to take your data.
Yeah, I completely agree. I applaud Apple for their stance on privacy. But if we go back to the tobacco analogy, there have been tons of successful lawsuits against big tobacco, yet cigarettes are still available for sale, and people can still buy cigarettes and smoke. And we all know that it's bad for your health. Social media does have its issues. Clearly, you could argue that it is a health issue, especially for the young, but social media benefits people in Congress. They use it just like everybody else uses social media. So we may see some type of regulations put in place like we do on cigarettes where there's a warning label, but I don't see any of these big social media platforms disappearing anytime in the future. Clearly, they're a tool that everybody uses, whether you're a business, whether you're in Congress, whether you are an individual. So I don't know what Congress is going to do, because clearly they're not going to ban social media, but it'll be interesting to see what stipulations, if anything, they put on social media.
Yeah. All right, Dan, let's wrap up with just this one final thought. A number pulled from, I believe, the Wall Street Journal is $17 million. That's the amount the Australian Federal Police recently prevented cyber criminals from stealing from Australians' retirement savings account. That total number is really equal to 24 million Australian dollars, but $17 million in the US. So just going back to what we were talking about last week, that sometimes, and maybe even slightly more frequently than in the past, the good guys are making some headway and gaining some ground. Good news.
Good news indeed.
As we wrap up for this episode, I want to thank our sponsors at Valcom. At Valcom, you get much more than a dedicated IT retailer. They become an extension of your IT team. So whether you're a startup or an enterprise, Valcom has the technical sales and engineering expertise to make your business more effective and more productive. Check them out, VLCM.com. That's VLCM.com. Special thanks as well to our supporting partners, the Utah Division of Technology Services, the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah, the Utah Attorney General's Office, the Utah Department of Public Safety, and of course, our friends at Secuvant. You can follow us on Twitter at Cyber24_, or you can follow us on Facebook as well. Feel free to hit us up in either place. Let us know what you think of the show, or even if you have a topic you'd like us to discuss on a future episode. You can also rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts. We love those 5-star ratings. They make a big difference for us and our audience. Thanks, everyone. Stay safe online.